20th, 2008. And I just want you all to know that tonight at 7 o'clock we will have a full lunar eclipse. And so that is the trivia of the day. And the next one won't be until 2010. So with that, I am delighted to open an informational hearing on the governor's presentation by the Governor's Council on Alcohol and Drug. And Stephanie Pump and will lead us off, and then everyone should introduce themselves.
Thank you very much, Senator. We're delighted to be here and appreciate the opportunity you've given us today. I'm Stephanie Suarez Pump, current chair of the Governor's Council on Alcohol and Drug Programs. With me today is Ann Uhler on my far left, the immediate past chair of the council. Sitting in between us is Geraldine Brennan, the epidemiologist for the Addictions and Mental Health Division. Mark Brandlin is a council member. He is with us today. And Andy Smith from the AMH, the legislative liaison. I'm not sure if that's his proper title, but that'll do. Gina, I almost said Furman. Gina Nickel, who is a liaison member with AOCMHP to the council, is also here with us today.
Good.
Thank you. You have asked for a briefing on two of the reports and an initiative that's coming up. So we're prepared to talk about the domino effect, our effectiveness report, and the underage drinking initiative that the governor has asked the council to lead. And we'll get into that a little bit more. I asked Geraldine to come prepared with her presentation because I believe some of the data that we now have available is quite remarkable. And we have used it to drive the decision-making process for the next biennium and two biennia beyond that. The council has just completed a regional strategic investment planning process with AMH and our partners, AOCMHP and OPERA, and are preparing our domino effect report for the coming biennium. But you have all been given copies of our current report, which was used by the governor and many legislators. Many of you who are members of this committee referenced this report. It turned out to be quite a remarkable undertaking. It was the first time in the history of the council that every word was written by a council member. And because of that, the governor kind of blessed and released us to go rabble rouse, as I'm fondly willing to call it. Basically, we designed a set of recommendations around rebuilding the prevention, treatment, and recovery system, which had been disinvested over the process of the budget cuts with the last three biennia. In the effectiveness report, which Ann will spend some time talking about, I would also call your attention to the list of losses that the prevention side of the continuum has experienced. The disinvestment has been the greatest in that part of our service delivery system. Something that I find quite puzzling, given that if we would invest in prevention of substance abuse, we would touch families in Head Start, education, classroom teachers, administrators, traffic safety, both adult and juvenile crime issues. There is a myriad of problems related to substance abuse, Senator, that could be addressed with the investment in our field. The council is charged with assessing the state of the state, if you will, of the economic and social impact of alcohol and drugs across our state. And that's what the domino effect reflected. And we called it that very purposely because we discovered as we went out into counties and did site visits and had testimony from state agencies and community representatives that the dominoes had fallen. And so again, we picked the phrase, the tagline, rebuilding, also very purposely, in order to rebuild the system, which we made some strides last session toward doing. This next session, we will come before you again with our investment recommendations and the new domino effect. So without any further ado, I wanted to reference, I talked some about the data. I want you to know that we have responded to the feedback that we've gotten from elected officials and key leaders in communities about not addressing outcomes and not using data very well. So I think we've gone a long way in the last even year and a half in addressing data issues. And Geralyn, when she makes her presentation, will make that evident, the way that we are currently using data. I want you to know that we use this data to generate these two reports. And so as we get into where we're at with the current state of the situation, it takes a it's worthy in time to take a look at where we've been. So, Anne, I'll turn it over to you to talk about the treatment end, and then I'll address some prevention issues, and then we'll have Geralyn make her presentation.
Good morning. I'm Anne Uhler, and thank you very much for hosting this today. I really appreciate an opportunity to talk with you. As you know, we made recommendations to increase treatment capacity over this over the last biennium, and laid out actually beginning doing 15% each year. In our new report, we'll tell you how we did. We did get some additional, which we are thrilled about. And so, in our new report, we'll bring you up to date on just how far we've come in that. In regards to the, I think we also recommended to double the prevention money, and that was, I believe, accomplished, as well as the drug court. There was money for more drug courts this last time, and that's certainly important. I wanted to spend a little more time, because it's a more recent report, in talking to you about effectiveness. And so if you'll turn to that report, it's this beautiful color salmon or something. And if you'll turn to the back, just open up the back, I just want to run down a couple and update you on the recommendations that we made. Does everybody have a copy? I have some extras if you don't. So it's the page 37, 30, 38, the very last part of that. As you can see, you all helped us repeal the...
And letter can't
record. Oh, you need some more. All right. Sorry. I'll have to catch up with me here. You all helped us repeal the UPPL law last time, but what I want to remind you about that is that there was... one difficulty.
UPPL is what?
UPPL.
It's a unified
public policy. It dealt with
law.
Emergency. Yeah.
It's
it dealt with emergency room admissions related to
emergency room
crashes.
Okay. Yes. Essentially, they if somebody came in under the influence with an injury, the insurance companies did not have to pay. What we discovered, that was a national law. And when the feds decided they'd change it, the only thing is they said it had to be done state by state. So we came to you, and sure enough, you repealed that. Essentially, several things we found about that was it doesn't mean that the people's injury was not being treated. It just means that it was being billed under that injury. And so, therefore, we had no idea of how many folks coming into emergency care actually were there because of alcohol and drug problems, because it was not recorded. Because if they recorded it, they didn't get paid. So this has helped. But I do want to remind you that it isn't we haven't solved the problem completely, in that the UPPL law applies both to group policies and individual. And the only one that we were able to repeal was for group policies. So we still have a piece to go forward this next round around individual. The training of physicians, the state has applied for some money to try to move us forward on that. And I just remind you that there's significant monies to be saved if, in fact, physicians are trained to identify and do a brief assessment and intervention, particularly with alcohol. There's still research on how to do the interventions around drug, but because, of course, alcohol is our bigger problem, even though that doesn't get a lot of press here. They're training physicians and allied healthcare workers actually ends up saving significant money in the healthcare world. And so, as well as it helps people then move forward to get to the help they need. But that's a big training endeavor that we have to do. Other states have done it. Washington State just did a big research piece called ESPERT, and in their hospitals, 50% of the folks coming into many of their hospitals had drug and alcohol, and that had been ignored. And now they receive brief intervention. And what they discover is just with a brief intervention, they're less apt to return because of an injury because of alcohol. Just a brief intervention. So what we're talking about is we're intervening earlier in people's lives rather than to wait until they're way down the disability.
And can I
add a question? Senator Cruz first and then...
Okay.
Describe, I mean, I'm trying to envision we're in an emergency room, they're overcrowded, and they're treating the injury, and they sometimes have very little time. Describe what the intervention would
well,
be.
Well, different states have done it differently. The one in Washington in particular, what they ended up doing, the grant allowed them to hire a specialist who served in the emergency room. So if any healthcare worker identified that perhaps there was alcohol or drug involved, mm-hmm. they would get referred to this person who is trained in doing brief interventions. But what they've discovered is it's become so popular that now hospitals are beginning to hire them themselves because they've seen the significance of being able to move people into treatment or to just cut down their costs. So it's there's a curriculum, a specified curriculum that can be taught. I've participated as a enroll training, becoming the client and helping to teach doctors how to do this kind of intervention. So there's a curriculum out there. It's available. It's just that we've got to get enough money to move forward in getting doctors trained. We want to work with it. You know, what we talk about here is a whole plan about it's not just the current doctors, but what about doctors that are being trained today? How do we intervene in that? In the medical schools and other allied workers. I don't know if that answered your question, Senator.
To a degree, I'd still like to see what the intervention would consist of. I guess my concern would be on a Saturday night when an ER is totally overloaded and that we're putting another requirement, another step on an ER doc who is rushing from patient to patient. You know, I mean, there could be potentially a workload issue.
You're raising a very valid point, and in fact, that's what's been interesting about the initiative that's happened across the country. Those are the very kinds of things that were brought up. But after they once experience having somebody there, they want to learn that what's turned out is some actually want to learn to do it so they don't have to call somebody else in. So it's moving the field forward to recognizing. Now, of course, if somebody's terribly inebriated, you can't do the brief.
No.
So generally, it's a little later than the initial, walk in the door kind of thing.
May I intervene just a second here, speaking about brief interventions? Another issue is that doctors don't get trained in medical school. They don't get addiction courses. Mm-hmm. Our medical school does 8 hours over the course of the 12 years of their education. And the other, recently I was privileged to join Dr. Andy Antoniscus, who is the former OMA president, and he chaired the OMA's methamphetamine task force. And Andy and I presented, made a presentation to the Standing Health Committee of the OMA, asking that addictions become a permanent part of that committee's charge. And they agreed to do that. And so these issues are in beginning discussions with the OMA, who is asking for this kind of information and training.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Is it Senator Marsha?
Oh, I have a comment question on funding, but we'll get to that later.
Okay.
I'll bet you do.
Wine tax, all those good things that we tried before.
We'll do that later.
Okay. Well, just to put one thing in, is that what they've discovered in primary care, that it only takes 4 primary care doctors to afford to pay for this behavioral specialist to come into their setting, and it ends up saving them money. We've got good research about that. So it can pay for itself by the savings, but okay. It's the money to do the training is the issue. Just to move along quickly here, another big issue in the field, and we're going to be watching this, you know, I worked very hard with the health plan, and actually we have it identified now officially with the health plan, is that addiction is a chronic illness, and therefore we need to treat it as a chronic illness. People need to be case managed over a period of time. It's not just we run them through and this works and that's it. You know, it is a chronic illness. So that's a whole change in treatment. That's a change in thinking about for treatment providers to think about. They're used to somebody come in the door and then supposedly treatment complete. They don't think about it as that they need to be managed over time. So there's a whole change in that, both in the treatment world and in the medical world. It's going on too around diabetes and other kinds of chronic illnesses, is how do we manage that care over time. And then of course we need the information systems to back this up as we begin to look at an institute. Then we've got to have information systems that can collect the data so that we can show qualitative and quantitative outcomes of care. So those are kind of big ones that we're still working on. The second one there listed, I just want to clarify and I want to justify what this is about. What we discovered when I looked at the data, 5 years of data, about outcomes for treatment complete, I discovered that several things. One is that African American and Native Americans entering prison have a much higher severity of their alcohol and drug than others. So it began to make me think, well, what's going on in the treatment world that we're, you know, that their severity is so much higher? Aren't we intervening earlier? You know, there shouldn't be. So then I went and looked at the treatment stats and started breaking it down and looking at what do we have going on here. Well, you probably have no idea about this detail, but there's about 5 different outcomes that are measured. The outcomes were similar across the board except for one thing, and that was employment. And that if there was more employment available, there would be more success for African American, Native American, and women in treatment. So this was we said, let's do an incentive. Let's find out what works and see if we can't increase the outcomes for those populations, which will end up saving us then, hopefully, in that we'll have fewer people going into the prison system with such a high severity of the illness. And then the last thing I want to talk, and you can read through the rest of this, but when we looked at the Dewey stats, we discovered that people that were more apt to reoffend, have a second Dewey, were people who had a co-occurring illness. Well, guess what? Most Dewey providers do not have psychiatrists, medical people to help them work with dual disorders. It's just not part of their funding, and they don't charge, you know, they can't charge additional money. So what we're saying is if we can improve this, the number of the DOEs that come in to get co-occurring services, that we'll have fewer reoffenses. So it, that's what this is about. So we'll be coming, we'll be coming forward with to you to talk about what can we do to increase the infrastructure for DOE providers so that they can actually do something with co-occurring and not just wait until they come back again and come back again. That's what we're seeing happening. So that's, and those are sort of the areas of improving effectiveness that we'll be working on again and that we're making recommendations. Then finally in that, I have passed out to you a one-page piece that says the National Voluntary Consensus Standards of Treatment. Now, part of what we did in this report, at this time there were three documents out on effectiveness, and for national, but there hadn't been any decision about which one should we go for. So lo and behold, we now have a consensus standard. So this is an update for you, and we'll include it in our new one. This is the National Consensus Standard on Treatment of Substance Abuse Condition on Evidence-Based Treatment Practices. And if you'll notice, the very first thing, one of the first things I talked to you about had to do with diagnosis and assessment and brief screening. And so we fit what we had recommended last time. We're fitting now with a national consensus of this is something that needs to be done. The other thing that I'm pleased about is under therapeutic inventions or interventions, it talks about the use of psychotropics or other medications that have been proven effective. You know, you may not know that we've actually had some providers in this state that refused to take anybody into treatment that had other medications. And I've just been very upset about that, because when you look at co-occurring, you look at all sorts of reasons. That's just, but I understand, because they didn't have the structure, the infrastructure. They don't have doctors, they don't have nurses, so they couldn't take anybody that needed medication. So now this says very clearly that is part of treatment. So therefore we need to make sure that there's the infrastructure there so that we're providing good care across the state. Finally, just one other report that I'm working on that I'm very concerned about has to do with, as you know, in order to do good care, we've got to have counselors. And we've got to have trained counselors. And in this state, and it's projected in 2008, we're only going to train 51 new counselors. This is all the programs across the state. That's all we're going to train. And yet, you know we need just to fill the gaps much more than that, let alone try to increase treatment capacity. Where are we going to get these folks? So I just want to alert you that we have a major, major problem.
And that's after losing 1,000 counselors.
Huh. Mm-hmm. Wow.
Over the course of the three biennia of cuts.
Wow.
Yes, Senator Morissette.
The cost avoidance is important. And if we spend a little money up front, we can save tons of money in the emergency room, in jails, in prisons, in broken families, broken homes, foster care. You go right down the list.
Alcohol, you say it better
drugs.
Than
exactly.
I do, sir.
and so on page 6 of the original report, which was the 07. The recommendation for funding is designate 10% of the distilled spirits revenue. Well, we settled for 2% last time. We did pass the bill. The Ways and Means took that out, and we're going to put in some general fund money instead. I think there was $17 million. I hope that went in instead of this.
It
but
did.
I still think, I don't see any reason why we can't do part of this.
Funding is one of the issues.
Well,
I
I'm talking about
today.
The distilled spirit.
I agree with you. I know Senator Cruz and yourself and worked hard on
that. The other part of this is equally important, and, you know, it's the beer tax again. It's the alcohol recovery fee is what we call it. We don't call it a beer tax. We call it a recovery fee. And we have one of the lowest in the nation. 10 cents at 8 ounce would put us probably
right.
one of the highest, but we need to do that. Now, the only way that I think had a chance is that if we share that with the state police. We're going to come back with a bill. We're going to go for an alcohol recovery fee, and we're going to designate part of that to the state police. That's the other end of it, you know. But if we do the cost avoidance, the state police won't be as busy picking people up off the freeway and off the pavement from drunk driving. So they go together, the law enforcement. And so this is alcohol, drug, mental health. People have the three conditions oftentimes. People with mental health oftentimes use alcohol
right.
and drugs illicitly and so on and so forth. So they're interchangeable. So we need to put additional funding in to avoid higher costs that we have to pay for, including emergency room, prisons, jails, broken homes, foster care, all of those things that are going to happen.
You'll get no argument from anybody on the council.
Well, we get arguments, though, when we introduce the bill.
Well, and we're hoping to diffuse some of that this next session, Senator, by recommending, we're putting in the process of putting a package together that will focus on a variety of revenue sources to fund prevention, treatment, and recovery. Both Mark Branlin and myself have been working with the Oregon Business Plan Work Drug Free Initiative, and they too, we've been working with them on this package. They recently commissioned the Eco Northwest research firm in Portland to do a survey on the level of cost that the state experiences in a given year due to alcohol and other drug problems. And their assessment was that in 2006, Oregon spent $5.9 billion, with a B, dollars, resolving these issues that are related to alcohol and other drugs. And so that's going to be part of our report, and we will put a funding package together that we hope will be an easier sell than just the beer tax or alcohol recovery fee has been.
Madam Chair, just
yes.
one other thing. And I really appreciate the fact that you recognize Senator Cruz's tremendous effort in raising these revenues. And he and I will continue to
yeah.
work together on the beer tax and the spirit tax and all of those things that we have worked so hard on.
Thank you. We
thank you, Senator Cruz.
I'd like to refer you
Senator Carter.
If Oregon spent $5.9 billion on 5.9, how is that money spent? I mean,
healthcare costs, law enforcement costs, treatment costs, lost productivity at work.
You know, I'm a ways and means person. I'm not supposed to ask the question here, but I certainly
no. Go right ahead.
We'll document it in our report.
Sure.
Yeah.
So I made the point as I introduced this process today that if we would fund on the front end, as you pointed out, Senator Morissette, we would touch Head Start, voc rehab, employment, traffic safety, both adult and juvenile crime. You know, the list goes on. So that will be my introduction to the next part of this presentation.
Just a follow-up on that, because I think it needs to be reiterated. I was talking with Judge Nan Waller,
mm-hmm.
and she was saying that there was less recidivism in the court system when they had the drug courts and the counselors, and then
right.
we cut and we cut and we cut,
right.
and now we have no place to refer them to. They are staying
That's
in
exactly
and
right.
they are not being cared for, and therefore they're going back out and then coming right back in, and it's a huge issue.
And this will illustrate that point. If you would turn to page 34.
in the salmon-colored report, the effectiveness report. This is a list of the losses experienced in the last three biennia on the prevention side, these two pages. Exacerbating the situation further is how fractured the prevention system is by public policy. We have a diffuse mandate in this state. The Commission on Children and Families has a huge responsibility for prevention. Addiction and mental health has a responsibility and a charge to deal with prevention. The Department of Ed has a charge to deal with prevention, etc. Some way to, the phrase has often been used, silo busting. You know, we have different application processes, different submission dates, different report dates, different plan guidelines, and despite the attempts of working together to get through all of that and to kind of codify and bring the system together, in fact, that's not happened. And that's another reason why we end up feeling like prevention and the treatment field is scattered, is because in many ways it is. So that's a huge public issue that I think we need to address in some kind of comprehensive way. That's one thing I wanted to call your attention to. On the back page of this, you'll see some recommendations that were made, and I just want to flag a couple of them. Number three talks about Senate Bill 267 that was passed two sessions ago, mandating that we deal with evidence-based practices. If you're having trouble with it, again, in the pink report on the literally the last page.
Okay.
Unfortunately, with that mandate, which many of us supported at the time and still support today, the resources to implement evidence-based programs with fidelity didn't follow the mandate in 267. And so that, coupled with the fact that counties and programs are not funded for all the administrative responsibilities they have, it's made it difficult to assure fidelity in implementation. So that was an issue that we felt, in particular, a committee such as this one could address some of those issues. We will continue to ask for some support in this part of programming. If
the Senator Cruz.
Yeah, Stephanie.
Yes.
Nice lead in. Are you going to be able to track or give us the potential impact of loss of timber dollars for those county services that the counties so graciously give to the state? Or is that
I think that's beyond our charge. We're all very aware of the effect of the loss of the safety net dollars.
Okay.
Our last site visit was in your county, and you were there for a good part of that day.
Right.
It's horrendous, and I've just been in Newport, and on the news last night was another report with all of the seven timber counties and the percent of revenue. Douglas is 69%. You know, I don't run for office because I can't handle issues like that.
Well, yeah.
Hopefully I'm sure
that the counties will have that information.
As we move forward towards 09, we're going to have, I mean, we know the big picture, but we're going to need to know some very specific areas of loss of the county support to what should be state programs or our state programs that the counties do, and you know what the loss is going to do and what our ultimate responsibility is going to be for those programs that really are our charge. So
I do have an opinion. When this hearing closes, I'd be glad to share what I think another one I wanted to flag.
Oh, and before you go on, Senator Gordley needs
Are you going to go through each of the recommendations, or are you just picking them out?
I'm just picking out. If you wanted to address one, please go ahead.
I do. I want to look at item two, and make a recommendation and get some feedback from you on your reaction to the recommendation. It appears to me that...
And that's on page 37, item 2.
Yes.
Yes.
Right. Improving the employment rate for
okay.
African American, Native
Thank
American,
you.
And women who are in treatment by offering incentives, et cetera. It appears to me, and correct me if I am wrong about this, that there may be some opportunities to partner mm-hmm. In the community. I was looking for a reference to the Office of Multicultural Health, for example, in the Department of Human Services, as a place to partner, mm-hmm. gather information, assess data. For example, there's a statement on page 19 in the other report, the Domino Effect Report, that says there are Hispanic, Asian, African American, and Russian service providers, but no single association or group representing these populations. But when I think of the African American population in particular, I know of organizations that would want to speak to this work. The African American Health Coalition is one. The Urban League of Portland is another. The president of the Urban League serves on the Oregon Health Fund Board. It just seems to me that there is an opportunity to partner and uh-huh. to build some relationships that could strengthen and enhance the good work, really good work that you all are doing. I'm thinking of Better People, which is another organization that works with folks who are transitioning out of institutions, prison, jails, but people who are also dealing with addictions and mental health issues.
Right.
But again, it's a relationship that could inform your work and inform the way in which you analyze where you want to target resources. Is this making sense to you?
Oh, absolutely. And ironically enough, I'm working with our staff liaison to set up our April meeting toward that very end.
Great.
And one of the things that the council's talked about is how can we help foster some advocacy organizations that not only would partner with us, but who would advocate here before you on a variety of these issues.
And I would just add one last comment. The section of the report that's titled Tribal Services
yes.
Domino, in it, that's fine, but it falls short of what really should be racial and ethnic populations
yes.
domino.
Yes.
And I would argue that we do have enough information that just needs to be gathered, analyzed.
That's a good point.
Put in a form that is understandable, and then we go forward from there.
That's an excellent point.
The Oregon Progress Board has a report that may have some value to you.
Thank you.
That looks at the progress of Oregon's racial and ethnic populations in a number of benchmark categories, including education, home ownership, health care. So we just need to
Great.
Make sure we're acknowledging what is being done out there and not minimize it, and this not intentionally. You follow one.
Yeah, I definitely. Yeah.
No, it was a struggle. Writing that one was
a good path.
Quite a struggle because we were aware that we were very short on information mm-hmm. and those kind of linkages. So
right,
I appreciate the feedback.
Yeah, I think it would be extremely important if you invite Senator Gordley, when she's through being a senator, to belong to your organization, to give you that kind of insider information.
That works for me.
The list of agencies is very long. But, of course, I would be happy to work with you now and
thank you.
And in the future. Because this is laying a great foundation, and I really appreciate the leadership that you're bringing forward.
Okay, I just want to flag one other recommendation on the effectiveness report, the pink copy, and then we'll have Geraldine come up. And that is recommendation 3A. I wanted to address the issue of the Oregon Healthy Teens Survey. Several years ago in the budget cuts, we eliminated surveying sixth grade. And yet we know from a variety of sources, including the existing Healthy Teen Survey, that kids are beginning to use substances, primarily alcohol, by age 11 and 12.
And that's what grades?
Fifth, sixth. And yet we have no information on that population. The second issue with the Healthy Teen Survey is there's no stable funding source for it. We cobble together funds from a variety of agencies who opt in and out as they are able, from biennium to biennium, sometimes year to year. And yet the information is incredibly valuable, not only from a planning standpoint, but from a federal funding standpoint. The federal government requires that we do some kind of survey in order to get the prevention and treatment block grant. Not every school district in the state participates. There are a myriad of concerns around the Healthy Teen Survey, but the two that you could influence are the additional revenue sources, acknowledging the value of this survey and what it brings to us in both planning and delivery of services, as well as maintaining funding from the block grant, and then getting a more accurate, realistic portrayal of what the situation is with our kids by adding sixth grade back in.
Can I ask a question here?
Yes.
Madam Chair. Is there linkage to the Commission for Children around this particular
Commission on Children and Families?
They are one of the funders
of the
and they
teen
use
survey.
The information as well.
Okay.
And many of their non-general fund grants that they get from the federal government and other sources also require data. Mm-hmm. So it is to their best interest to invest in it as well.
Okay. It's very, very difficult, especially in certain schools, to get permission to...
I understand.
We had a difficult time just getting the high school student, the survey in the high school students in Oregon City, and then let alone middle school. And this was at Oregon City High School. And so that's the dilemma, because a lot of parents feel that if they're exposed to questions, then that will actually make them want to...
And
they're asking if I do this. Well, I don't. Well, maybe I should do it.
There are researchers who are prepared to go into schools and work with parent groups and help mitigate some of that belief. I'm pleased that we do have quite a bit of data to share with you. And Geraldine Brennan is the epidemiologist for addictions and mental health, and she will take the next section of this report.
Thank you for having me, Chair, and committee members. My name is Geraldine Brennan, and I am a prevention epidemiologist with the Addictions and Mental Health Division. The work that I
might pull it a little bit closer.
A little closer? Okay. The work that I've been doing is funded by a grant through the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. So I began this work about 18 months ago. And the purpose of the project that I'm working on was to really summarize what's the magnitude of substance use, alcohol, tobacco, and drug use in the state, and the consequences of that use. And when we look at the consequences, we're very, very careful to just look at those indicators that we know are associated with substance use. So we stay away from service-related indicators. Those things that change depending on whether or not there's a policy that now says we're going to emphasize really focusing on minors in possession. So we don't look at that. We really look at those things. We're trying to look at those things that are consequences that are not easily affected by funding decisions. So we look at things like consequences such as abuse and dependence rates, mortality rates, crime rates. And crime rates as crimes against persons, which are, there's research that shows that alcohol has, there's certain attribution rates for alcohol use and violence against people. And we look at property crimes in association with illicit drugs. So in these 18 months, we've looked at 9 different data sources and over 45 different indicators. It was a lot of information. And I was asked to present what's the prevention take-home message. When we look at the whole big ball of wax, alcohol, tobacco, and drugs, what is that thing that is rises up to the top as remarkable? And when I look at it in that way, and I'm trying to get to a 5-minute message for anyone in the audience, it's one thing. It's alcohol, alcohol, alcohol. Tobacco may be more have more deaths. Those people who do smoke live much longer. But this state has the 4th highest rate of alcohol-attributed disease deaths. When I say disease deaths, I'm talking about chronic liver disease, deaths to cancers that are associated with alcohol use, pancreatitis, those kinds of diseases. We're not talking about accidents. We're not talking about murder. We're not talking about suicide, which are also attributable to alcohol use. So when we talk about prevention, we're really focusing on youth. So I looked at a number of indicators using Oregon Healthy Teen Survey data, and these are just some examples of consequences to youth who are using alcohol. We found that alcohol use during youth increases the likelihood of becoming an alcohol-dependent adult. And that research, that's not the Healthy Teen Survey, but that research shows that youth who start drinking before age 14 are 4 times more likely to become alcohol-dependent than people who wait until they're 21 to start drinking. And if you wait until you're 25, it even goes, you're much less likely to become alcohol dependent. The earlier you start, the greater the risk. We found that of those kids who said that they drank on one or more occasions in the past month, 1 in 12 of them said that they missed school or class because of their drinking. We see that same kind of pattern once they grow up and are in the workplace. Of 8th grade girls who said that they were binge drinkers, 1/4 of them also reported that they attempted suicide. That's a much higher rate than the general population. And we also know that about 1/4 of the motor vehicle fatalities for persons under 21 years involve alcohol. That's the leading cause of accident death for youth across the nation. When we look at the whole spectrum of what do kids use? What is it that they're doing? We find that there's 5 top substances that children use. Alcohol, marijuana, tobacco, inhalants, and prescription drugs. 35 out of the 36 counties, those are the top 5. There's only one county that differs, and in that county, stimulants is slightly higher than inhalant or prescription drug use. For all other substances, it's generally 1 to less than 1% of substance use. So what we see is that in eighth grade, three times as many kids say that they drank as smoked marijuana or smoked tobacco. In 11th grade, it's 2.5 times as many kids. Almost half of the 11th graders report that they drank alcohol in one or more times in the past month.
The percentage of people who smoke is usually right around, 20%, 18-20% of the population?
Adults.
And we have here 19% of youth smoking at the 11th grade.
16%
is marijuana. Gotcha, 19% is marijuana. All right.
Marijuana and tobacco use are about the same for youth.
All right.
Slightly higher for marijuana in 11th grade, which by itself is remarkable.
Senator Morissette.
Well, in terms of suicide slash alcohol syndrome, do they drink because they have a problem? And I'm wondering if there are, you know, not exacerbating circumstances. Now, it could be mental illness. It could be a mental problem. It could be family stress and so on. So does the drinking come first or does the problem come first?
That's a very good question. And, you know, lots of times you can't, it's not easy to tell one or the other because these problems come in bunches.
Yeah.
And that's what we really see. We really see that, and I'll give you an example, we really see that substance use issues amongst youth are just one of a group of issues. And if you really want to know among youth how many of them have multiple problems, look at the binge drinking rate. Because when we looked at the Healthy Teen Survey, the kids who smoke, they're much more likely to have other problems. And when I say other problems, I'm talking about they say they skipped school, they were in fights, they had unprotected sex, all kinds of problems. And that's what the Healthy Teen Survey data is really remarkable for, that we can look at those multiple issues. But the most remarkable thing to me was then when we looked at substance use and what other problems might be occurring at the same time, 100% of the 8th graders and 11th graders, every one of them who said that they were a binge drinker at least one time in the past month had multiple problems. Every one of them. And the binge drinking rate amongst 8th graders in 2007 was 13%. And the binge drinking rate amongst 11th graders was 27%.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Gordley.
How does the picture change if you disaggregate the data that we see there on that particular information that we see on that slide?
You mean among minorities, Senator?
Race, ethnicity, gender, how does the picture change?
That's a good question. I don't know off the top of my head, but I do have the information. The gender differences, except for alcohol. Amongst alcohol use in the early years, girls are more likely to drink. In eighth grade, we see higher rates of use amongst girls. By 11th grade, it's really close. Some years, the boys are ahead by a point or two, and some years, they're the same. So by 11th grade, the boys have caught up, sometimes overtaken the girls. County by county, there's a few differences.
County, urban, rural? Are you able to disaggregate in that way, urban and rural?
I have my little chart. I brought it with me. I went and looked at 30-day alcohol use and binge drinking use, and there's only a few counties that have lower rates than the state average that are statistically significant. Okay, most of the state is pretty much the same. We see that Benton, Clackamas, Union, and Washington counties, just those four, They're the only four that are statistically significant with lower rates of alcohol use. Higher rates, we see Clatsop, Crook, Deschutes, Douglas, Jefferson, Klamath, Tillamook, and Wallawa.
Mm-hmm. Again, the disaggregated information is very helpful.
We don't have information for Lincoln.
Oh, that's right. They just did.
They just started. So I don't have their. Lincoln participated in 2001, did not participate for a number of years, and they just started participating again. So I don't have theirs.
The disaggregated information, which is why I always ask for it, no matter what committee I'm serving on, is one of our diagnostic tools, if you will. It helps us understand in a deeper way what the issues are, and not generalizing them, but and it also allows us to do a more effective job of targeting our strategies to intervene and prevent. So to give us a more complete report, I would want the committee to have that information, Madam Chair.
We also see that when it comes to race and ethnicity, that Native American youth seem to have higher binge drinking rates, but the 30-day use rates aren't necessary. From year to year, they're not necessarily higher, but the binge drinking rates are.
And suicide.
Yeah, and suicide. The Hispanic youth are at less risk for alcohol use, both binge drinking and 30-day use.
How do we know that?
I looked at those numbers. Yeah.
Statewide.
Yes, okay. Statewide.
And we can get you this data.
Mm-hmm. And when it comes to African-American youth, the 11th grade numbers are very, very difficult to say with certainty if the difference is statistically significant, and that's a sampling issue.
Mm-hmm.
We, at the Healthy Teen subcommittee meeting I was at yesterday, we talked about a need to oversample for certain groups, Asian Pacific Islanders. Again, in 11th grade, we just, from year to year, we may or may not have enough of them in a sample to know even if their numbers look really high or really low, there may not be enough in the sample to know if it's statistically significant. So, but in general, the white non-Hispanic population in this state has higher alcohol use and binge drinking rates than Hispanic, than 30-day use for Native Americans and for blacks, and binge drinking use tends to be higher amongst the Native Americans, but then the whites have higher binge drinking rates than the rest in general. But I could give you the specific numbers if you would like those.
The graph that you have here on percent of youth drinking alcohol in the last 30 days, I'm concerned that the bar graph shows that in Oregon we have a much higher alcohol rate at 8th grade compared to the United States.
That's one of the reasons why alcohol is my mantra. Because what we see is, when we look at the numbers, we see that in the United States there's been, let me see if I could find the...
I mean, it's significant,
it's
almost twice as much.
It's 76% higher. I don't have U.S. numbers in 2007, so I can't tell you most recently. But in the United States, the 8th grade drinking rate dropped about 26%. And in Oregon, 8th grade drinking rate increased,
2%, 3%, 2%, 1%. But I guess what
27%.
Where I'm going, where I'm going with this is, if nationwide that they are decreasing use of alcohol in eighth grade,
right,
and we are increasing, are there strategies in the other states where it's actually decreasing? What are they doing differently than what we're doing?
I can't tell you that piece.
I can answer for three states that I'm familiar with. And that is a significant investment on the prevention side.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Morrison.
I think there is ample evidence to show that when we put a lot of money into alcohol cessation, it had a
yes.
tremendous impact
exactly.
on quitting smoking. And they, in Lane County, they used to go into the stores and try to, you know, they would send people in to try to buy cigarettes, and if they could buy them, the store was in big trouble. I mean, there was, then suddenly we stopped putting money into that, and the rates are going up.
Exactly.
And I would imagine the same with alcohol.
It's you know. True for both prevention and treatment.
Yeah.
When we
yeah.
invest in prevention and treatment, yeah. we see very different outcomes. And we are in the process now of trying to go back into archival data yeah. in Oregon.
Good.
To capture it during the years where we fully funded prevention and treatment as comparison to the more recent years,
mm-hmm.
to see if we can't make a better case for fund for more
yeah.
for again rebuilding the investment in prevention, treatment, and recovery.
Well, also don't forget the cost.
Yeah, well, one other thing.
When it's cheap, it's more.
When we were discussing this in our groups of legislators, there are those legislators who did not strongly support
right.
Smoking cessation dollars going in because they didn't see the value of them. And it's very, I think you need to go back and get that data for both
mm-hmm.
alcohol and drug prevention and the methods that were used at the local level.
Mm-hmm.
To do that. They were very, very effective,
absolutely.
And suddenly we withdrew the money and the rates are going up.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Senator Carter.
I was a part of the committee that reorganized and collaborated mm-hmm. across institutional lines in this state and looking at drug and alcohol. The problem then is, as it is today, even though we did a little better because there was a committed group of legislators that were here, but we did not use evidence-based data. And number two, we still are not using it to the greatest degree in terms of outcomes that people want to see. But most of us who are involved and engaged in this process understand that this is somewhat of a soft business. I mean, you cannot always have data that speaks to the issue of why kids do what they do or why adults do what they do around alcohol. But to the greatest degree possible, we need to have more people in research, on the research end of it, that's giving us the outcomes and the data in terms of successes. And I think that's what we don't have and have not had. And you guys are better at it than any of the group that I have any committee than I've ever been on before. You've done a much better job of collecting and collaborating, and so I think that that's really important. But I think that if we see outcomes and we see success ratios, I think you're going to see a group of people who want to see our children helped in this state, and also to see that whole issue around alcoholism, and especially when it comes down to suicides among our teens, being able to reduce that number, because one is absolutely too much. But
and Oregon's rate is higher than the national
yes,
average.
Absolutely. And so therefore we need to do something about it. But I think continuing to give us data and having the kind of outcomes that we can look at what we're buying, I think is going to make a difference. But just to ask for money and not have some kind of outcomes and to know how the taxpayers' dollars are being spent will continue to be an issue.
I agree with you, and I think the council in particular has worked very hard in trying to come up with more effective ways to make our case. And the domino effect was the first attempt at doing that in a different way. And it was clearly a successful attempt, so we're not going to, you know, if it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Yeah.
We're headed in that direction again. But I also wanted to, that we apparently didn't keep going through the presentation often enough, so it's died on us. But I wanted to...
Could I go over just a couple other things?
Oh, sure. And then I want to make a point about,
yeah.
to follow up on mm-hmm. your point, Senator Carter.
Senator Carter and Senator Morissette both mentioned a number of things that are, you know, the question of why is it going up. I can't say this is the one thing, but I did provide two charts that compared adult tobacco use and adult alcohol use. One thing that we do know about children is they want to grow up.
Right.
And they practice being adults. And they practice being the adults they want to be. And when you look at those two charts, one of the stark contrasts is that when we're talking about alcohol and we're talking about what environment is our youth living in, mm-hmm. they're living in an environment where the most educated people are most likely to be drinking, and those with the highest income are most likely to be drinking. This is something that is desirable. It's just part of our culture, and that means that when we work on prevention efforts, we really, really have to invest a lot into changing our culture. And we do that through a lot of different strategies. So at the very end, the last two slides that you have in your handouts, let me get to them. We talk about having an array of services, prevention strategies, alternative activities, community-based strategies, drug-free workplaces, prevention education, environmental strategies, information dissemination, problem identification, and referral. And I just want to give a couple examples to kind of bring home the difference between preventing smoking and preventing alcohol use. We know that a certain level of alcohol consumption really is not bad for you. But does the public know what that level is? Because it's a very small amount. One drink per day for a woman, two for men. That's the kind of prevention education and information dissemination that helps change the culture of a state, that helps change the environment our kids grow up in. And when we talk about alternative activities, we're talking about when kids are in middle school and the way that they're learning to socialize is by getting lubricated by drinking, and that's when they become more comfortable to socialize, they will carry that with them their entire lives. So alternative activities, alcohol-free, drug-free activities that really help kids learn how to socialize, how to relax and enjoy and relate with each other without those substances, and being able to move that into workplaces. Why in our workplaces do we have, is it acceptable that in an employer-sponsored event that they serve alcohol at a company picnic or a Christmas party? Why is that acceptable when we know that there are people that probably work in that environment who have substance issues and it's probably very insensitive? But those kinds of issues are issues that we've dealt with over decades now regarding tobacco, and we've seen things change. It's no longer considered impolite to not have an ashtray in your living room in case a smoker comes to visit. Well, that mindset about alcohol and prevention, that's the mindset that we're faced with now. Our kids are in a situation growing up where alcohol is something that the most educated, the highest income people do. It is the thing that you can do to relax, to have fun. And that makes it very difficult. It's not a simple one message, this will kill you if you smoke. It's not that simple a message. There is a certain level that is healthful, but that defining, that really requires a lot of steps. It takes a lot of different kinds of strategies, not just one strategy, to create the environment for our youth.
Senator Morissette.
Very briefly. A lot of it is cultural, and when I grew up in a small town in Montana, there were a lot of people from other countries who made wine and who used to drink wine all the time. And when I would visit my friend when I was in fourth, fifth grade, his father would go down and get a glass of wine and bring it up and give me wine and others and so on, which is interesting. A cultural kind of thing. Now, you have done some studies on Hispanics and Asians. Now, some cultures, that's part of their family tradition. And I don't know if that's as much the case now in Oregon as it was in some of these, I think certainly the Hispanic culture, mm-hmm. and you say they have a less of a problem. That's interesting, because that is one of the strongest things going, is the family orientation, the family ties. And if we have fractured families, it makes it much more difficult. But that was just an observation. I don't know if there are still groups that have that drinking culture.
In the United States?
Yeah, there are.
There are. I grew up in an Italian immigrant home. And yes.
Yeah, okay.
And it was very prescribed family way of drinking. I mean, you learned the right way and what the circumstances were. Yeah.
And I grew up with a grandmother who was president of the WCTU. And you're all old enough to remember what that means.
Say it for the record.
Women's Christian Temperance Union.
Oh, yeah, right.
Senator Carter.
This might be, I'll have to get my staff to get the data on it, but have you seen the data? New York Times did an article about 4 or 5 months ago where it talked about how African Americans metabolize alcohol different.
Hmm.
Mm-hmm. And our intake of alcohol cannot be as high as other groups because we metabolize it different. But it was a great article.
Japanese have an enzyme missing that creates the same problem.
Right.
There's wonderful research out now, and if we have time, I was going to make the five of you guinea pigs, if you're willing to do this, to do an exercise I do when I'm training to illustrate how the brain functions and what happens with chemical substances. One of the things that we've all started to say lately because of the research is that this is a brain disease. Mm-hmm. It is all about the neurochemical response in our brains to the substances that are introduced, and the centers of the brain, the pleasure centers, the reward centers that are triggered with the introduction of these chemical substances and the neurotransmitters that they trigger. And if we could get past this is a willpower issue, it may be the first time you start to use or the first period of time while you are using, but there's a line that you cross for people who are going to be addicted. There is a line that gets crossed that has everything to do with the connections in the brain. And once that happens, it's not anywhere near a willpower issue. It's all controlled by brain chemistry.
Madam Chair, I don't think we can do that experiment before lunch. We can't do that on an empty stomach.
So let me thank you and to just wrap up by saying a couple of things. I'm going to leave two of these reports with you. These are the full epidemiological outcome reports that we used at the strategic investment sessions that we held around the state. And I also wanted to show you how local communities can deal with this. In Douglas County, we produced with the coalition there, DC CAPS, what we called the Drug Impact Index. And it was all Douglas County statistics. And we took that and launched that report to the employer network that was a part of the coalition. And it turned out none of us were prepared for it being such a catalyst as it turned out to be. Of the 43 employer network members who were at that round table, we ended up printing 5,000 more copies of the report because they all wanted to go back to their workplaces and their civic clubs and their churches. And it ended up being a whole initiative that began in Douglas County to deal not just with the workplace issues, but with the community's response to their incredible problems. The CARSA Coalition in the Portland area with Oregon Partnership has produced what's called the Portland Profile. I'm out of drug impact indexes, and a new one is being produced, so perhaps Senator Cruz could share that with you later. But, you know, this is an excellent way for communities to take profile data and use it to promote prevention and treatment and recovery locally. And Geraldine's epidemiological work group is in the process of publishing a profile for every single one of our counties. So this will be available all across the state in all of your districts.
I have one more thing I'd like to add. Okay. The teacher part of me says, I don't want anybody to leave this room without understanding that one or two drinks for adults, the brain does not fully develop until mid-20s. Mm-hmm. So we're talking about adults over mid-20s. The decision-making part of the brain is not fully developed until that age. And you put alcohol in there, you're going to delay development of the brain. So please, I just don't want people going out of here, well, you know, if 18-year-olds drink one or two, it's no big deal. Oh, yes, it is.
And, in fact, age 21 is literally a compromise between the range, 19 to 22, of when all the parts of the brain are fully developed. And the other thing that Anne reminded me, there's a researcher, when he does a brain research presentation, he talks about this being the yes part and this being the no part. And the no part of the brain is the last part of the brain to develop. It's the occipital lobe. So everything's running by the frontal lobe, and it's not developed yet. There's no decision-making, thinking, critical decision-making skills. But what there is spontaneity and impulse galore. So when you look at your teenage grandchildren or children and you think, what is this I'm living with? That's what you're living with. You're living with the yes part, this part of the brain functioning before this one does.
Now, are you, saying that young people tend to be more liberal, and as you get older, you tend to be more conservative? You go from a yes person to a no person. Is that right?
Well, it's really time to go.
Thank you very much for this presentation. I really appreciate it, and who knows when we'll be able to have another presentation regarding implementation of some of the need statute.
I was neglectful in not announcing that Senator Lori Moniz Anderson has just agreed to chair an initiative that the governor has asked the council to undertake on underage drinking.
Great.
So hopefully we can come back and talk
first
more about
that. First meeting is the 29th, so.
Yes. Yeah. From hopefully 1 we'll to 5 at the Red Lion, you're all invited if you would like to attend.
Mm-hmm. And I want to let you know that at this point we have no agenda for Friday, so this may be our last meeting, but the meetings haven't been closed down yet, so we'll have to wait and see regarding whether we're... So just stay. This may be the last.
Believe you me.
Yes, Senator Gordley.
Yeah, I just think I'm glad that you're going to be leading that the governor's effort. I think that the information that was shared toward the end here about the relationship to brain disease and, you know, making the distinction between that and willpower or character, it's so important. It's so critical. So. To have, there needs to be an emphasis on that, mm-hmm. public education that is focused on the stigma
yes.
associated with not understanding, and the stigma that is associated with ignorance. And so in future documents, I hope that you will incorporate information that talks about that piece of it.
Thank you.
It's huge.
Any other comments for the good of the order? Thank you very much. We're adjourned.